Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is the podcast where various guests tell me the five things from their life, no matter how insignificant they may seem to others, that they would choose to preserve in a time capsule. Four things they cherish and would like to keep safe, and one thing they loathe and would want to bury in the ground and never have to contemplate again. My guest in this episode is Justin Morehouse, who describes himself as a comedian, actor, parent, undercover vegan, podcaster, and dog walker. And indeed, he has been many things in his time, before discovering his talent for stand-up at the age of 29. He was a salesman for many years, before getting the role of young Kenny in Peter Kay's Phoenix Nights. He also appeared in the film Looking for Eric, alongside Eric Cantona, Lucky Devil, and has been in Michael McIntyre's Comedy Roadshow, Still Open All Hours, Celebrity Mastermind, and alongside his pal John Thompson in Celebrity Haunted Hotel Live, Unlucky Devil. Plus, he played Dean Upton in Coronation Street. He wrote and performed his own BBC Radio 4 sitcom, Everyone Quite Likes Justin, and he's been a presenter on a number of commercial radio shows and now regularly presents his own show on BBC Radio Manchester. He also presents his own podcast called About 30 Minutes, No More Than 45. So, to ring the changes, Justin and I spoke for more than 45 minutes. And it was worth it, as I hope you'll discover now.
In the first lockdown, I started, I was worried about money and one thing and another and all those other things that come with it. But touch wood, things have been okay and I managed to keep a bit of work going and one thing and another. But then it's purpose, isn't it? It's about what you do.
Yeah.
And both me and Jason Manford, we both started driving for the car scheme. So we take old people to get their hair done. But do you know what? It's just so good to, like, and I start tomorrow back with them on the COVID injection run.
Oh, great.
So just going backwards and forwards, taking them. And it's always just, you've got, I think the one thing about this lockdown and this, for me anyway, has been the sense that there are more good people in the world than bad people. Like a lot of people, I've pressed pause on a lot of things.
Yeah.
And gone, yeah, this is important, that's not important, you know.
Yeah.
I'm quite into, I mean, have we started the podcast yet? But we're just having a chat, but I'm quite into stoicism. The idea that, you know, the simple stuff, you know, like control the controllables and this too shall pass and all those things. And, you know, I'm not a religious person or even a spiritual person, but practically that's how I deal with things.
Yeah.
In the psychiatrist's chair, I feel very much at ease with you, Michael.
Oh, that's lovely. Good.
Yeah. The last time I saw you, I don't know if you know this, I came to see you doing the revival of Radioactive.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, at the Fringe.
How was it? Did you like it?
I loved it.
Oh, bless
what
you.
I loved about it Because obviously the scripts have not been changed.
No, lazy buggers.
I really enjoyed it. It was good, great fun.
Oh, good.
I had to explain status quo to my daughter.
Oh, lovely. Justin, it's really great to have you on My Time Capsule. So we're going to talk about the five things from your life that you want to put into a time capsule.
Right. So what I've done is, because I entered my sixth decade this year, last year, I would turn 50 in lockdown. I looked back and I thought, well, I've completed five decades. So I'll pick a thing from each decade of my life.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
And that'll give you an insight into who I am, because reading between the lines, that's what this podcast is all about, isn't it?
You know? You have read between the lines. That is what it's about. It's about how to find out about someone in a sort of a roundabout way.
Yeah. So the first one I'm going to pick is a red plastic toy car, which you could sit in when you were a child. And I had this when I was about four. And it's the one possession I've ever had. I can still smell it. I can still feel the roughness of the plastic on the seat and the smoothness where I got in and out of it a few times. It was like Lego quality, but in a car. It was chunky and everything else. And the reason I remember it is because when I was about four or five, and I don't really know why, my parents divorced, or they split up, me and my little brother, and we went off to my grandparents for I don't know how long. I don't remember these things. But I remember my granddad buying me this car and my mum saying to me, your granddad's your dad now.
Oh, Lord.
And, yeah, and then I remember that, and I remember my grandparents' house. It was a lovely, you know, kind of memory, and the car was great, and they lived in a kind of proper northern, old-fashioned, two up, two down backyard. They had a toilet in the back. I mean, they had an inside toilet as well, but they still had an outside toilet you could use. Mm. And I remember going round in this car and everything else. And the reason why I mention it and the reason why I want to keep hold of it, because and I did say to you that I would probably go deep on this, because it's a thing that stuck with me a lot, because I and then after my mum and dad, this is the weirdest thing, after my mother and father split, my mum remarried and we got a new dad and we changed our name. Then I became Morehouse. Morehouse is quite a northern name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Before that, I had an even more northern name. I was called Clegg. So I was called Clegg. And I had calipers when I was little. I had Perthes in my hips.
Oh, right.
So you can imagine what I was called at school. Peg Leg Clegg. Here he is. Anyway, God. But that didn't affect me as much as... And it's only in the last 12 months where I've had one or two little struggles with things. And I had some therapy and talked about one or two things. And I've only realised now that I've spent all my life wondering why my dad didn't want me. Because my dad, my father, the man who is my father, I have no relationship with. I never had a relationship with him until I was about 18 and I tried. And I know where he is now and I can get hold of him and need him, but we have no relation. I don't know his birthday. I don't know anything about him. My mum remarried to a brilliant, gorgeous man who took me and my brother on. And he passed away last year, and this is probably what prompted, well, I know it is what prompted a lot of stuff that I went through. And it made me evaluate things, because I looked at this man who died, who'd been my dad. He'd not been my father, he'd been my dad. And he died, and I felt weird. I felt a disconnection that my other siblings had with him, because he was their dad and he was their blood. And it's such a weird thing. And if you've never been through something similar, it's hard to describe that feeling. You know, you expect that kind of weeping and wailing. Do you remember Victoria Wood used to talk about funerals, and they'd say on the continent they'd throw themselves on a funeral pyre and demonstrative. And we're not very demonstrative people,
no,
Brits.
Sorry for your loss, we say.
Yeah. Or even my family. We don't talk about anything. We don't never talk about the big stuff. We never bring anything up, and it festers for years. And I have a difficult relationship with that, and I have a difficult relationship with my thoughts about the man who brought me up and the thoughts about the man who didn't want to be my dad. And that transfers itself in the way that I parent my children now, in negative ways sometimes. Have I got to check myself and all that? But that red car, that red car symbolises the happiest time of my life was when my mum and dad split up. That's such a weird take on that, isn't
it? That is weird, isn't it? You get moved to your grandparents, you get told your granddad's now your dad.
Yeah.
and they buy you this car and you go, this is great.
This is great.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose really, if that is the happiest time, you must have been unhappy before. You must have, in a way, as a tiny child, sensed the trauma that was coming, I suppose.
Well, I would imagine so, because knowing my mum, like I've known her for 50 years, she's not very good at hiding how she feels about things. So I would imagine there was some transference. And there were some things that, and I don't want to be disparaging because, you know, they fuck you up, your mum and dad, you know, they don't mean to. But, you know, it's not their fault. As Larkin said, it's not their fault. And they were children, they were boomers, you know, children of the war and brought up by Victorian parents.
Yeah.
Essentially, my dad, my stepfather, who's my dad, his mother had died young and his stepmother was awful. There's all these things going on and he was institutionalised. He'd been in the army and he was a beautiful, great, great man. The word step is such a weird thing and it's not real. There's no such thing as a stepfather or a stepmother. It comes from a German, Steop. And the Steop child is a child that has no parent. So it's an orphan. That's what it means.
Right.
And we've just reappropriated the Steop to step. The word step, actually, if you think about it in a positive way, it's somebody who steps up or steps in.
Yeah.
You know, they're not a step removed, they're a step closer.
Mm.
So I've kind of come to terms with, he was a good man and I'm not complaining about him, but I think it's really important that, and it's very interesting now that friends of mine adopt and have fostered and one or two things, that kids know where they come from.
Mm.
Kids know, but I don't know anything about my one half of my ancestry. I don't know if there's any disease there or if there's any, you know, these things are important.
Have you asked him? I mean, if you're in contact with him, have you ever asked him why he just felt able to just stop seeing you?
Well, my mum and him agreed that that would be the reason. I never got adopted by my stepfather, but we changed our names by Deepole.
Right.
And that was kind of to fit in and, you know, we all had the same name and that was easier. This is the 70s. It's a different time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, everybody was getting divorced, you know. I did try and reach out to him. When I had my own son, I tried to establish a relationship with him. And then I thought, I don't want to put him through this because he's now got two granddads. So really, that red car is my happiest memory of being a kid. I don't want this to come out wrong. I wasn't unhappy in any way. I wasn't unhappy. I have been unhappy since about that.
Mm.
Are making sense?
It does make sense. Actually, at the time, you think to yourself, well, that's okay, all right. Now, I should imagine the moment you moved in with your grandparents, you felt safe.
I can't really remember that because I was very young. I don't have a solid memory like that. That's probably why the red car is symbolic and is very much a forefront. And we weren't there forever. We went back to the house and my mum kept the house and we lived in it till she sold it when we were in our 20s. So you know, she went back to the house and she married my dad quite quickly. See, this is weird. But I'll tell you this, Michael, I'll tell you this, and I don't want to labour the point, and I don't want it to be miserable about this, and I don't want to upset anybody alive or dead. But there's something that my mum said, and she said to me, you can see Keith if you want, which is the name of the man whose genes I've got. You can see Keith if you want, but what will your dad think?
Wow.
And that's like, boom, isn't it?
That is confusing, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I just went, okay. Called him dad. I mean, it's caused a little bit of a rift now with my younger siblings who I love as equally as I love my other sibling, that they, because they never knew any different.
He is their father, is that
what
you said?
He is their father, and he had no other kids, and they have not got any other older half-siblings. And we never used the word half, you know. And we don't in our family now, because my son and my daughter are half-siblings, but they, you know, it's brother and sister. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's brother and sister's the people you're with, isn't it? But
absolutely. I think it's more to do with circumstances, where you are and who you spend the time with than actual blood ties and things.
But anyway, my red car was lovely.
I bet it was. And the great thing about it is that you would have been driving that around in a tiny little backyard.
Yeah.
And it would have been the world.
I was doing a lot of 3-point turns.
Well, that's the most fun you can have in a little red car.
I've turned this podcast into a Ken Loach film, haven't I?
Oh, Justin, come home. Well, I will put it into the time capsule for you then, Justin, and keep it safe, because it's clearly a very precious memory.
The reason I put it in there and the reason I wanted to talk about it, because I do realise this is a personal podcast and it's very much that sort of thing, because I think it establishes who I am and yeah. It's my motivation and everything else. So shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. It's all in right. The time capsule. Let's move on to item number two.
A picture of my dead aunt. No. A skeleton of the first pet I ever loved. I'm going to put a ZX Spectrum computer in there.
Oh, brilliant. You better explain it, because I should imagine there are many people who haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about.
All right,
about.
So I'm not very techie, but I love gadgets. So I don't know how they work, but I love buying them. So I buy the latest thing. I got the watch and the iPad and I love all that stuff. And the idea that you could have this thing in your house that connected to your television that you could play games on or I didn't even know what word processing was, but word process. And we got it when I was about, I think I would have been about 13, about 1983, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get the very first, the very first one was a ZX80, then a ZX81, then we got the ZX83, the Spectrum, which was the colour one.
Oh, brilliant.
And this was going to be so exciting. And it was, and it's just something that I remember getting into. And I think I'm so lucky. I don't know how old you are, Michael. I think I'm a little bit younger than you.
You are. I will be... Well, I only found out the other day, actually, that I will be 63 in a few weeks' time.
You only found out the other day?
Yeah, I thought I was 63 already.
Oh, right. I thought you had a story like me. You had a different dad and your birth certificate was all false.
No, nothing complicated, just stupidity.
Yeah, well, I think I'm 13 years luckier than you because I was born into this white heat of computer technology and the sort of stuff. I mean, so I didn't grow up with the internet, but by the time I was in my 20s, the internet was around and I got used to everything very quickly. And I got a mobile phone when I was in my 20s. And so I've always loved that sort of thing. But my love of it started with the ZX Spectrum and playing the games and with friends and friendships and buying magazines. And it gave me a lifelong love of being part of a club and a gang and that sort of stuff. And I don't know if you were ever into computers.
No, I think probably being slightly older, it was one of those things that eventually I got into really for the word processing part of it. I remember a friend bringing round one of the first Apple computers.
Was that friend one of the previous guests on your podcast?
No, it wasn't. No, it was a friend of mine called Ramsey Gilderdale. Ramsey Wilson Gilderdale, in fact, his full name is. He now lives in Sicily and is an estate agent in Sicily, but he was a brilliant actor. He was in a fantastic series called Maid Marian with
Mark Billingham.
That's right, Mark Billingham.
Yeah, who I play poker with sometimes online.
Oh, do you? Well, send him my regards. How lovely.
He's normally very grumpy.
He said, oh, God, I'm so grumpy on my pockets are so full of money. I don't know what to do with it all.
I'll put it in one of these rooms I forgot I had. He's doing well, isn't he?
Yeah, very good.
In case anyone's listening doesn't know who we're talking about, Mark Billingham is a crime writer, isn't he? He writes the... I forgot what the name of his books are called.
Money for Nothing?
No, they're called... It's Detective Thorne, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, they're really good, actually. I like them.
All the people in them are named after comedians.
Oh, I'd never noticed that.
So Thorne is Paul Thorne, and there's a Kitson, who's Daniel Kitson, and there's all these different people who he put in when he first started writing them. But he was, selling millions of books and still working the weekend at the comedy store, and he would compare, and it would be, 2 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, and he's doing the late show, and I'm thinking, what are you doing, mate? What are you doing? You could just swan in and do a Thursday night if you wanted to. You don't have to do the graft.
No, buy the theatre.
Yeah, put your own shows on, Andrew Lloyd Webber it. So I put the ZX Spectrum in there because I'm not a gamer, but I love computers. I love browsing. I love YouTube. I can get lost in YouTube for days, Just go down rabbit holes. I look at pimple popping things and all sorts of rubbish. And I watch, Irish travellers fighting.
Who wouldn't?
Oh, they're just great. But then it's not the fighting so much. I don't know if you've ever seen in these videos.
No.
It's more the calling out. So they'll call each other out and they'll say, I'm here in Carrickfergus. You come for me, I'll come for you. Bring your family and all this sort of thing. And it's all done, and there'll be ones behind them going, yeah, yeah. It's great. So I put the ZX Spectrum in there to kind of symbolise I'm a computer user, not a computer nerd.
Mm.
So I love computers, I love gadgets, I love all that sort of stuff. So I'm into all that.
And what were you doing then in the 80s, early 80s?
So what was I doing in the 80s? I was at school, I was a schoolboy. I was 11 in 1981. I kind of wasn't very good at school. I wasn't good at school. Well, I was bright enough. I was the kid who always had his hand up. I always had the answers. I could do all the work, but I never did any work. Not a tap. Genuinely, not a thing. And I was predicted to get 7 or 8 O-levels and be all fine and everything else. I didn't do any work. I'm not kidding. No revision. Because I used to saunter in and get the work, pass the exams, it'd be fine. And I failed at that hurdle.
Yeah.
So we were on holiday and we came back for our results. We were a little bit late because I had to go in and get them after everybody else. And the caretaker gave me mine.
Oh, no.
And as he handed them over, he looked at them and he went, oh, dear. And I got one O-level in English and the rest were terrible. So I was 16, 1986. I had no desires to do what we do now as a living. I never, no thought of it, despite my starring role as Boy 3 in The King and I at the Hyde Little Theatre in Romley.
I remember the reviews. Fantastic.
Yes. The notices, as we called them, Michael.
Yeah, of course, yes.
Yes. The notices were marvellous.
When I took my, O-levels, I absolutely fucked them up completely.
Yeah.
I mean, I only took 5. I was at a secondary modern school, so I only took 5 O-levels, but just terrible results.
Really?
And by rights, I should have then left school, but I said to the teacher, but I want to go to sixth form. I want to stay on. And he said, but look at your results. They're terrible. What are you going to do? And I said, well, give me a chance. And, you know, bless him. He said, OK, but, you know, come Christmas, we're going to have another look at your work and see if it's up to standard. And by Christmas, I was, you know, top of the class. Put my head down. He gave me that chance, and it opened a whole new world.
Failing those exams had probably given you the wake-up call you needed.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I never... I mean, this is going to sound like this entire podcast is me complaining about my parents. But they didn't push me. Sort of a little bit of bitterness and resentment comes from the fact that my brother went to the Manchester Grammar School.
Right.
Which is an incredibly good school. And because I applied for these independent private schools and passed a couple of exams, but my parents couldn't afford to send me. By the time my brother was going, luckily my dad had been made redundant, so he got a bursary. I mean, this is weird. So he ended up going to this good school, and it was really good, and he wasn't any less bright than I was or anything else, but he had that thing at school where they cared about them, they pushed them and everything else, and I would get in trouble, and why don't you be more like your brother? And I said, well, look at his school. It's not the school. I said... Because the previous people who'd been to his school were like Sir Ben Kingsley and Jonathan Powell. And I said, he goes to school with Gandhi and Jesus. My school is sons of bank robbers and all sorts of stuff.
Also, the expectation that teachers put on you at that point.
Yeah.
If you're at those sort of schools, they sort of go, well, you've done what we sort of expected you to do, not do very well. So, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and also, I think because I was quite nice, I was never in trouble at school. I was always pleasant and personable and I would help the teachers out and do things. But there was weeks where I just didn't go and no one really checked on me. I don't remember very much about school. I have very little actual memory of lessons and everything else. Everything I've learned in my life, I've read since. I look back at my school time now and doing what I do now for a job, I think to myself, it's such a shame there isn't a way of majoring in something when you're at high school. Because if I'd have been taught basic science, basic maths, arithmetic, temperature that a kettle boils and the stuff you need to know. I have no interest in physics, no interest in chemistry or biology, huge interest in geography, history, English, drama. I could have spent 50% of my time doing that and 50% of my time doing the basic life skills stuff that you need to do.
Yeah.
But no, you have to do an equal amount of science and equal, and it's not for everybody because as soon as you get to 16, you go, oh, I'm not doing science or languages anymore. I'm going to do politics and history and English and the fun stuff. So it's such a strange thing. I mean, kids do know their mind when they're 11, 12, 13. They know what they like.
Mm.
And we're prescribing this forced kind of idea that, you know, it's a strange one, I think.
Well, it also people are worried that if they specialise at that age, then that'll be them stuck. Whereas I can cite them the example of my wife, who was a great arts student at school.
Mm-hmm.
Was predicted to get very good A-level results, had a very high temperature when she was supposed to take her A-levels, and didn't pick up education again until she was in her mid-20s when we already had 2 children. Mm-hmm. And she picked it up and went back to the local school and did chemistry, biology and physics A-level because she'd never studied them. Mm. She said, I'd never had any interest in them before and I'd be quite interested to see what they are. Yeah. And she's now a doctor of science. She's got a PhD.
We write people off, don't we? I think, you know, there's some things that, I mean, a 13-year-old doesn't need to know trigonometry to the level we teach it.
No,
you
we
know,
don't.
No one ever uses it, you know? No one ever uses it, you know? Cosine and this and Bodmus and all these things. You know, calculator works for me and, you know, I can add up in my head. I'm bright enough to do that. I'm fine. I'm fine like that. I do regret not going to university, not doing that sort of stuff. I started work at 16 and I think I lost a lot of time doing that. I was in the wilderness for a few years, really. Till I did what I do now. 16 to 29, I had a variety of jobs that I didn't enjoy, and which brings us nicely onto my third item.
Let's move on to our next item. So we're going to take the spectrum, the colour one.
Yeah.
Beautiful. We're going to put it into the time capsule. That's two items we've got in there.
And if anyone's interested, it was a 48K. It wasn't the 128 with the added-in tape player.
Right. No one is interested.
Okay. All right.
Okay, this is the part near the middle of the podcast where we take a short break for the podcasters to slip some ads in. If we're lucky, we'll be back in a moment.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back. Right, let's return to my chat with Justin Morehouse to find out what else he wants to put in his time capsule.
My next item is, talking of technology, a pager, a BT pager, and I'll do you a quick impression of it. It used to go, do-do-do-do-do-do, this is your anxiety, do-do-do-do-do, all your fears are coming, do-do-do-do-do. So the reason why I had a pager, this was just before mobile phones, and so quick précis of my career. 16, I left school, I went on a YTS scheme. I did it through the Chamber of Commerce in Manchester and I became a shipping clerk. At 16, I worked in this grand building next to the Palace Theatre in Manchester called St. James's Buildings, beautiful white building on the fifth floor. And I worked for a shipping line and I was doing all the documentation for shipping bills of lading and letters of credit. At 16, and I was bobbing all over the city centre, delivering things to banks, going to post offices. I was in the bowels of this magnificent building doing filing. Loved it. Loved that kind of stuff. And I worked for another couple of companies and I was doing all right, but in low pay admin. But that was my education. That was me hanging out with older men, the older boys, you know, who to me looked like grown-ups and they were only 18, 19. And then I went to Felixstowe when I was about 19 because that was the home of shipping as it still is now. And that was the start of the downward spiral for me in the early part of my 20s because I was a wastrel. I was not very good with money. I remember I had no friends. I saw the Batman film, the Tim Burton Batman film. Mm. I saw it every night for a week in Felixstowe at the cinema because I had nothing else to do. I loved it. I loved the film, but I was so miserable. I was coming back most weekends. And anyway, eventually after 6-7 months, it didn't work out for me there. I came back, I left all my stuff there and I never got it back. And it was all very messy. I ended up moving into accommodation with friends and bumming around, basically bummed around. For a time, I was essentially homeless. I was living sleeping in a car for a long time in the summer. and I was sort of like relying on the stranger kind of friends.
Mm.
So I was in my early 20s, so a lot of my friends were similar sort of age and their parents were working and maybe they were at university or something, so we would all bum around together, but they had a reason to bum around because they were off, you know, but I was still... And I used to wait till my friend Jackie's parents would go to work and then I would get the train up to where she lived and she'd let me have a shower and wash my clothes, and I was very, very lucky that I had friends like that. And then I sort of pulled myself together a little bit and got a job, proper job then in sales. I used to sell plastic building products. And then I got with the mother of my eldest son and we set up home together and I got a proper job then and I started working in transport. I worked for companies like TNT and Parcel and all these. I was a salesman. I was basically selling delivery services. I mean, really fascinatingly boring. It just genuinely... I remember once, I'll tell you this, Michael, we were at the... I don't know if you've ever been to the Metropole Hilton in Birmingham at the NEC.
I have, yeah.
It's a huge hotel and it's always conferences. I mean, I work there now doing after-dinner stuff, and when I go there, I'm so chuffed that I'm going earning money, not coming to one of these sales conferences. We had this huge conference on and we'd been there all day, and then in the evening it was the awards and the party night, and Edwin Starr sang.
Brilliant.
And he was great, but there's all these pissed up account managers from Tewkesbury who didn't care. And I was, because I like music and, you know, I knew what Edwin Starr was. And I was just watching him and just looking at him. I didn't realize now, what I know now is that he didn't give a damn. He was doing a corporate. He's probably getting paid a small fortune in and out. Whoa, what is it good for? About 20 grand. And then, you know, off he went. That's what I realized that now. And then they did the sort of a presentation of what, if you achieve your targets next year, if you surpass them by just 10%, you'll be going to, and they pressed a button and the screen exploded and it was Mexico. Mariachi band came out, streamers, piñatas, 2 weeks, luxury exotic thing in Cancun, if you do this, everything. And everybody was stood on the chairs going, whoa, yes! And I just sat there like that. And my manager goes, what's the matter with you? I said, nothing. He said, well, are you not excited? I said, the last thing I want to do is go on holiday for 2 weeks with these pricks. I couldn't think of anything worse. And he went, I don't think this job is for you, is it really?
Yeah.
So I moved on. I was very good at knowing when I was going to get fired. I knew when I was going to get fired and I would get the next job and I would move on and that sort of thing. But the pager comes in because...
Yeah, who gave you the pager first?
So the pager, I was working for this company in Burnley and it was a really dreary job. It was in an old... Roadline, do you remember that company, Roadline? There used to be a transport company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was an old Roadline depot. It wasn't Roadline, it was another company. I don't exist anymore, but I won't name them. I will not give them the satisfaction of naming them. So I worked up at this company in Burnley. My patch was Manchester, and I was a salesman, and my job was to get new business. And I had this one boss who was awful. He'd worked his way up from the being a driver to being the depot manager. And he was just a bit racist and a bit sexist and a bit home. You could just tell. Mm. He wasn't a nice bloke. Anyway, I was 27, 28 by this time, and he bullied me. He bullied me. Because by this time I had my son, who was a babe in arms. My wife, I was married, actually. My wife. I don't even listen to the Adam Buxton podcast. That just made me think of him. My wife at the time was working, but, you know, we needed both wages to come in to pay the bills. We had a new house and everything else. And he bullied me. He put a lot of pressure on me, and it wasn't great. And they were short-staffed. And he used to get me to come in for 7 o'clock every morning to help the depot get the vans out for the deliveries to do paperwork and one thing and other, because they were short-staffed, which meant me getting up at 5:30 in Manchester, getting ready with a brand-new baby, you know, sleepless nights. And he used to berate me. He was very nasty, and people challenged him in front of me. He said, why are you treating him like that? And he used to say, because kittens can't fuck cats. That's what he used to say. He was an awful man, awful, awful man. Anyway, I'd had enough. I was depressed. I hated the job so much. And then one day I woke up and I'd overslept. I'd overslept by about 3 hours. And I just, you know those days when you just, both of you don't wake up, the baby had slept in.
Yeah.
And it was like 8 o'clock and we both woke up and went, oh, I should have been working an hour ago. I got in the car, got ready, started driving up, and this pager went off. It kept beep, beep, beep. So what you'd have to do is the pager would go off. You'd go to a phone box, you'd phone the office, and they'd go, Mr. X wants to speak to you.
Yeah.
And it would inevitably, invariably be him. He'd want to speak to me, and it'd normally be, where are you? What are you doing? And I knew this was coming. Anyway, this pager went off, and I was about a mile from my house. I'm crossing a bridge at a place called Globe Lane in Duckingfield, and it's the Peak Forest Canal. And I got out of the car to use the phone, and I saw the canal, and I saw the pager, and I threw it in the canal.
Brilliant.
I threw it in the canal, and I'd made two phone calls. The first phone call I made to my bank to find out if I'd been paid, and I had. And I transferred my wages into my savings account.
Mm.
And the next call I made was to the office, and I said, tell what's-his-face, I quit, and he can come and get the car, because I had a company car. And they were like, what? Just, and I just did it. I just quit. And I went back and I told my wife and I explained what had happened. And she was a bit worried, but I phoned a couple of people by then and I'd got some part-time driving work. And this is me. I will always find work. And, you know, so they came to get the car and it was brilliant because he came, the bloke, and he just couldn't stand that he'd lost. So he was at the door and my wife went to the door to answer the door. And he went, oh, it's just in here. And I just leaned back off the sofa and I went, the keys are in the car, mate. And he went, well, I went, that's enough, thank you. And I never saw him again.
Great.
And it was a liberating moment to throw that pager in there and just go, you know what, done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not without its risks, but sometimes you've got to do that. You've got to look after yourself.
I think so, particularly if, you know, you're being bullied. And
it was bullying. It was. There's no other way of looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've seen it. We've all seen it.
Yeah.
People with power, just knowing they've got the power. And as in your case, thinking that you're trapped. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
And they can keep going and you'll never get away from it. They've got you as a prisoner.
Yeah, it's awful.
And then you throw the keys, you know. You say, that's it, I've unlocked the door and I've thrown the keys away, you can't lock me up anymore.
For me, that was temporary because that ended and I got on with my life and everything else that's happened since is part of that story.
Mm.
But he'll never change.
No.
He'll always be that person that did that. And I'm not the only one he's done that to. He'll have done that to other people, you know?
Yes, yes.
I'd rather people think fondly of me than, you know, anything. That's the that's why I'm a comedian. I only care what people think about me.
You know? Okay, the pager's in there. So what's your next one? Let's move on a decade.
The next one is an SM58 microphone, which is the standard microphone that singers and comedians use. And this is for my 30s to 40s. So I was 29 when I started doing stand-up for the first time. I'd never thought of doing stand-up. I used to go and watch loads of stand-up, and I was a bit of a Peter Kay and a Johnny Vegas sort of groupie and Ross Noble, and I used to love these guys. I used to go to the Frog and Bucket in Manchester and to the Buzz in Charlton, and it was amazing. The people I've seen, you know, Tim Vine and Al Murray and all these people I've seen that I still remember how great they were. And I got back into doing sort of sales, and I was driving down the road one day, and I think I was listening to a comedian on Radio 5 or something, and I thought to myself, how do you become a comedian? Because I love comedy and I'm quite funny and things like that. So it was like a movie. I phoned a comedy club up and I said, how do you become a comedian? And they said, well, we have these things called open mic nights. You know, you need to. And the guy said to me, he's called Scott. I remember he went, you need balls of steel. So he booked me in for a couple of weeks later because they were full for the next couple of weeks doing Edinburgh previews. I didn't even know what that meant. I just went, yes, of course, yes. Edinburgh previews, of course. And booked myself in. I had to do 5 minutes.
And almost certainly the reason he booked you in is because everybody else was going to Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, of course, yeah. So I turned up and I told one person at work, and there was about 50 of them. And it could have been a nightmare, but they were brilliant. They loved it. And I did really well. The first one, you speak to any comedian, ask about their first gig, it'll either be terrible or fantastic. No one has a middling first gig. And the first one was super. It was just so good. I felt great. I did this 5 minutes. I thought, I'm a comedian. I went back the week afterwards with a brand new 5 minutes of material because I thought that's what you had to do. I was chewing gum. Chewing gum to stand up. And died. Died the death of a thousand deaths. And then the third week I went back and I sort of mixed it up a bit and I did all right. And I thought to myself, then I went, you know what? I'm 29. I've done three gigs. How do I say I used to be a comedian? Mm. How do I give this up? Who says I'm an ex-clown? So I threw myself into it. So in the first year of doing stand-up, I did 250 shows in a year. I did everywhere that you could do. I would go to London, do four a night and drive back through the night. I'd go to Coventry and do 5 minutes on a Monday. I'd do all these things. I'd run around and I got good quickly. I must have been all right, but I got really good quickly. I worked hard. I mean, my marriage failed, but I worked hard and everything else. I was doing all this work. And then one day I was in the office and there's a knock at the door and this guy comes to the door. There's a bailiff. And he'd come to remove the vans from work because somebody had not paid a parking fine. From parking outside a gig in Chesterfield about 6 months before. This 30 quid parking fine was now 800 quid.
Oh, my God.
And I just kept putting it off, and I never dealt with it. I never dealt with it, which is a constant in my life. Never dealt with it. And I had to phone my mate, Mike. And I said, Mike, have you got any money on your credit card? And he said, yes. I said, will you pay this and I'll pay you back? And he did. And then the boss came to me and he said, for the second time in my career in real life, I don't think this is for you, is it? And I said, no, it's not. And we agreed a severance package. And I kept the car for a couple of months. I got a month's wear, and it was good. Because the car was great to be a stand-up comedian. A company car, mobile phone and a laptop. It was like perfect, you know. Expense account. It was the world's best open spot. So then I went full-time. I went full-time as a comedian within a year. And then 6 weeks after that, I got a part in Phoenix Nights.
Wow.
What happened is I met Peter Kay and everybody knew he was making this program. And I said to him, could I have an audition? Because I wanted to know what you did in an audition. I wanted to know what you did, you know. And he went, yeah, you can. You can have an audition. He said, because you're the first one that's asked for an audition, not for a part. Everybody said, can I have a part? So I went for the audition. And it's only now the naivety of not knowing what to do helped me because I did what they asked me to do. And then they said, can you do it this way? So I did it that way. Then they said, can you do it halfway between? Mm-hmm. And I did that. And all they're looking for there, as you know, is to see if you can take direction, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
If you can respond to direction. And I did. And then he phoned me up at the night. He said, you got this part. And I was going to be in a TV show. This was like 12 months from being a comedian. And I went into the temporary job I had the next day. I was working at a repair team for the council. And I said, I won't be coming in again. And they said, why is that? I said, because I've got a part in a TV show.
And who would know that it would turn out to be such an iconic show?
Exactly. Well, who would know it would only be 6 weeks' work and then I'd be skint again at Christmas? Because you just think you're in a TV show.
I'm made forever.
But bizarrely, and this is, the microphone is going in because for me, the microphone is everything that I do, and I'm very lucky that I do lots of different things, radio and voiceovers and a bit of this and a bit of that, but the microphone symbolises stand-up comedy, and stand-up comedy has been, and I don't use this phrase lightly, Michael, at all, it's been a lifesaver.
Mm.
It literally has been the thing that has made me happy, content, comfortable, everything else, fulfilled. You know, if I didn't do anything else and I just went on stage three or four nights a week, I've made it, you know. For me, it's amazing. What it's given me is incredible, you know. Every chance I've ever had and everything I've ever done since wouldn't have happened for me without stand-up. Maybe going back those years and I'd gone to sixth form and I look back now and I think, I wish I'd gone to drama school. I wish I'd done these things. I wish I'd trained to act because I love it. I love show business. I love everything. I love the idea of the water rats. I love the 5 minute call. I love show. I love it. I love it. Love it. Love it. I think you have to, don't you? Otherwise, it's not for you. Mm. And that microphone for me symbolizes that. There's a little addendum to this story, and I'll tell you this because you're an actor and you'll appreciate this.
Okay.
So, straight after I'd had that audition and got the part in Phoenix Nights, I get another call from the casting agent to say, would you go up for something else? So I said, yeah, I'm one for one.
Yeah. I'm about to get it.
I'll get this, yeah. And it was for two films, two short films we're making on BBC Two, for this director, and he was called Danny, what's he called? Danny, he's done a couple of things, like the Olympics and that. He's from
Boyle?
Radcliffe. Pardon?
Danny Boyle?
Danny Boyle, yes. So it's two parts for Danny Boyle. Okay?
I've never heard of him.
Yeah. No. I go in the room and he tells me this is an amazing fact. He said, I was the first person to audition for him for these two things. I was the first person through the door. And he said to me, he said, do you know the last person I cast? I said, no, he said Leonardo DiCaprio off the beach. He's literally the last person he cast. And I didn't know. He said to me, he said, anything you want to ask me before we do this? And I don't know if you know Toby Haydock. Toby Haydock's an actor. He's a writer and Doctor Who aficionado. Mm-hmm. And I told Toby about going for this thing, and he told me this little thing to say. Only after me doing it and then telling Toby, did Toby say, I was kidding. So I said to Danny Boyle, he said, anything you want to ask me? I said, yeah. I said, you know that scene in Shallow Grave where they're burying the body and it's illuminated by the taillights? And he says, yes. I said, well, have you seen Goodfellas where they're burying a body and it's illuminated by the taillights? He said, yes. I said, when does homage end and plagiarism begin? And Danny Boyle called me a cheeky cunt.
Brilliant.
And I didn't get the part. I didn't get the part.
Oh, no.
But I'll tell you who gets the parts, and then you'll see, well, you were all right. The two parts I went for eventually went to Christopher Eccleston and Timothy Spall. So I'm kind of like, you know what? May the best men win.
Absolutely. We've all been in that situation.
Yeah. So the microphone for me is, it symbolises what this, you know, my 30s became. And it's almost like I've written this thing because it does lead me on to my next thing. Can the microphone go in?
I'm just going to check. Is that a Shure?
It's the Shure SM58. It's the microphone of choice.
Fantastic. There we are.
And my final item then, symbolises my 40s, is a script.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be any script, but just a script. I love scripts. I love the feel of them. And I've been very lucky to do some... I've not done many things, but I've been very lucky to do some, for me, very important things. And the most important things I've done are two plays at the Royal Exchange, mm-hmm. where I'd never thought I would get a chance to do anything like that, which I loved. And I wish I'd done more of now, but circumstances have dictated I haven't. When you're in it, when you get an acting job and you first get your script, it's great, isn't it? It's great. You know, you go through it and you get your pen and you mark your lines down and you carry that around, little notes. And I love seeing actors' scripts in the green room when they've been in, you know, rehearsals for 2 or 3 weeks, and there's things like pick up the cat and there's don't forget milk scribbled on it and people's phone numbers and,
yeah.
you know, little bits of direction, thoughts and all that sort of stuff on that. So scripts like that is very important to me. I love that. I wrote a play for Radio 4, an afternoon play once, and that script, you spoke to Steve Edge, didn't you?
Yeah.
And Stevie Edge helped me with a little bit of that. And the actors, when they get all that, had Roy Hood in it and Roy Barraclough.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it was an incredible, lovely play that
yeah.
I mean, I listened back to it recently. I don't think it's that good anymore. But at the time, I loved it. It was called An Insurance Inspector Calls. Bleach has been spilled in a Blackpool guest house. And it's conference season soon, so they need to get it replaced.
Oh, nice.
And Roy Barraclough turns up as the insurance inspector,
yeah.
and he unravels the life of the people who live in the house. So, yeah, it's really good fun. So when you first get a script with your name on, written by, and it's got the names of the actors on, the BBC scripts are very classically looking, aren't they? Mm-hmm. They've not changed. We mentioned about going to see your radioactive shows.
Yeah.
And I think in the brochure or something I've seen, the script...
They're exactly the same. They've never changed the format.
They've never changed. So that kind of thing, and who the BA is and how long it is, and the phone numbers are on the front now and scribbled out.
The date is going to be broadcast, the date is recorded.
Yeah, yeah. It's lovely. So scripts are taken because I think as I've got a bit older and a bit longer in stand-up, I still love stand-up, as I mentioned, with the microphone, but I'm keen to do more acting and writing and that sort of thing. And committing things to paper as a comedian is... unusual. The idea that the script is king is really interesting.
Mm.
The only time I've never worked with a script is when I did a Ken Loach film. I did Looking for Eric with Eric Cantona.
I know. I read that and I was very jealous. I have once been touched on the shoulder by Eric Cantona, but that was as close as I got.
When I first met him, so I get the part with Ken Loach and he phones me up, Ken Loach. I'm driving down Piccadilly in London. Going doing, I don't know why I'm driving on Piccadilly. It's night, it's stupid, wasn't it? But phone goes and Ken Loach goes, can you keep a secret? And I said, yeah. I thought he was going to tell me he was a Tory or something. He said, can you keep a secret? I said, yeah, yeah. He said, we've got Eric Cantona in the film. I said, oh, my God. Because nobody knew that he was going to be in it. I mean, even Steve Evans, the lead actor, didn't know until he appears on screen.
God.
He said, yeah, Eric Cantona's going to be in the film. So I said, oh, that's amazing. He said, what I want to do? He said, I want to do a bit of improv with you and Eric so you can get used to the speech patterns and the speed. And it was me and John Henshaw. And it's like there's two people's voices that you wouldn't pick to do. It's Johnny talks out the side of his mouth like that. And me, it's like Phyllis Pierce from Corrie, you know. All right, then, Percy, cup of tea, a slice of cake. So we went and did these this thing with him in some offices next to the Royal Exchange Theatre. And it was really, it was fun. You know, we did this improv with him and everything else. And at one point, we're having a cup of tea and he pushes the plate of biscuits over to me and he says, would you like a jamais d'ajou? I said, no, thank you, Eric. But the point of telling you that story is that, because I don't know how you feel about this, and I know some actors are reticent to do this kind of work, but you don't get a script. Occasionally you'll get a page. Most of the time you'll get a bit of direction. And we only got a script on the final day of filming.
Good Lord.
Yeah, and they film it all sequentially, so you don't know the story. And
no.
There's some criticism of that, isn't it? That you're not acting actors to act. You're asking them to react to real life, aren't you?
I can see that criticism, but at the same time, you are saying to them, this is your character, so you have to stay in character for those things. You're not you. Same with Mike Lee.
Yeah, but he does it more in depth, doesn't he? He might ask you to... The story, isn't it, where someone's been a deep-sea fisherman for 6 months and forgot that they're not making the film anymore. He's gone undercover to be getting to thing. So scripts, I'm gonna put scripts in there if that's all right. It's also a slice of where we are now that when somebody opens this time capsule, because that's what you want, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
They open it and they go, oh, this guy was he's a man of letters despite his 1-0 level off the caretaker.
And look, he's written little notes by this. This is rubbish. Well, he had no idea what this. He didn't understand this play at all.
That character's nuanced. He's played it with a straight bat.
Yep, absolutely. Well, now I love a script as well. I do love a script, so I'm happy to put. We'll put a pile of them in there. The only difference between what used to be a BBC script, a BBC radio script, and what you get now is that the paper now is better quality.
Really?
So, in fact, it makes more noise, which is annoying.
Ah.
It used to be really flimsy stuff, so it was like almost like cloth.
Yeah.
So you could turn the page without making a noise.
When I did the news quiz for the first time, I looked across and I thought, what's Jeremy Hardy doing? But he was clapping off mic. So when they applaud, you just do it off the mic. It's a really nice thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really, I thought, well, I've learned something today from the master. That's
the
how
master,
you do these things. I remember the first radio drama I did where I was acting in it and I got the contract and it was like, you get 50 pence and no lunch and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not very well paid, is it?
No.
And it said, bring some hard sole shoes and a pencil. That's not changed since Round the Horn, has it?
No, not really.
Bring your own hard-soled shoes to make, so you have to walk up gravel, don't you?
Yeah.
and then a pencil. The pencil is to stop it scratching on the paper, isn't it?
Yeah, a soft pencil.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so we've got five things in there. The pager is the one you want to get rid of.
Definitely, because that symbolises an awful time in my life. You know, sometimes adversity can spur you on.
Out of all situations that are awful, you find a sort of a ray of hope because that moment of throwing that pager into the canal is a glorious moment.
Getting rid of the pager was the thing, so it's gone.
Gone.
One day they drain that canal and they go, look at these navvies, they had pagers in the 1783 when they built this canal.
Oh, Justin, thank you so much. What a really lovely collection of things to go into the time capsule.
Is that all right?
Yeah, it's been really lovely talking to you. And as you say, I feel really at ease chatting with you. And we've never met.
No, just seen you on stage.
But I would have thought that would have put you off.
No, at all. And we have mutual friends.
We do.
The people that know you are the kind of people that go, oh, well, if he's friends with them,
that's
he's a
nice.
Good guy. And I think, Michael, you straddle the world of theatre and comedy lovely, don't you? Yeah, that's...
I try to.
Yeah.
What that means is I'll do anything they offer me.
He doesn't these days. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Thank you.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Justin Morehouse. If you had fun, then you can subscribe to this podcast on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. You can, in some circumstances, leave a review and rate the podcast as well, which we always appreciate. You can follow me or My Time Capsule on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook to find out what's coming up, and you can download the theme tune, which you can hear in the background. There it is. Very nice. Written by Pass the Peas Music on Spotify. The producer of this podcast was John Fenton Stevens, and it was a cast-off production. I mean, I realise that could be misinterpreted, the term cast-off. It could be seen as being a nautical term, but, well, it isn't. I mean, I once knew a sailor with a wooden leg called Smith, as they say in Mary Poppins, and I knew another one with a wooden chest. Very useful in a scrum. Still, it's nothing to do with that. Oh, and we don't intend for you to think we're referring to the show as you would some old clothes that have been tossed aside or cast off, as some people say. I mean, it's certainly not that. No way. No, I think the idea was that by using the word cast in cast off, we would make you think of the word podcast. You see, podcast as in cast off. You see, therefore you would associate the thing you're listening to with a podcast, which is what you're listening to. Yeah, I wish I'd never started this. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.